Go.
Sure. So as Rabbi Nathan said, I'm Linda Holtzman. I teach at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, and I work with a group that we call the Tikkun Olam Chavura, which is a chavura, a community that does different kinds of social justice, political justice work. And it's a really nice group. My credential for coming tonight is that I seem to spend a lot of time working with people around issues of death and dying and mourning, and I coordinate and lead the Chevra Kadisha, the progressive group, Jewish group in Philadelphia that prepares bodies for burial in a traditional way. So I was here a few years ago teaching about Tahara, how do you do the ritual of body preparation? And it's great to be here tonight to just continue the conversation to other areas around death and around mourning. So if we could start by, if you would introduce yourself and tell me your name, and if there's anything in particular, I obviously brought more handouts than I could possibly use in one hour and a half class, but if there's anything in particular around just the you know, how what do you do around death that you would like to talk about, that you have a question about, if you would, you know, share that, please. So
I'm Marian Hammermish, and I can't articulate any questions at the moment.
Great.
I'm Larry Hammermish, and no questions. We've thought a lot about the issue.
Good.
And experienced it.
Right.
My name is Joyce Romanoff. I want a quick fun fact about Rabbi Holtzman. You married my husband to his first wife.
It happened.
I'm really sorry. Had I known.
Can we talk about death instead?
Death of the marriage.
Oh, dear.
In particular, I don't know if it's a topic, but if we could talk about how Shiva should be done.
Okay, yeah, we could start with Shiva and work backwards. Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
That's great.
Sure.
I'm Jennifer Lowey, and at the moment, no questions.
Great.
Hi, I'm Thierry. I have a question about donation of organs and donation of
organs. Okay.
Joe Deitch, and I was just wondering, I don't know if it's in your topic, but about all these new concrete liners of how that is, and
yeah, I don't know a lot about liners, really. You could get someone from a cemetery who could come in and give you all the details. It's actually really interesting to learn the way that cemeteries work and what legally you have to do and what some cemeteries just choose to do, and because that's all based on location, you know, like what the law is in that particular location usually. But, yeah.
Evergreen, you want to go Evergreen?
I am Lois Hage, and no specific questions. In our synagogue, when there is a loss, there's just so many different levels of people knowing what to do. Homogenize?
Yeah, great question. That is a question. It's a great question.
I do have a question that was in this cremation.
We can talk about cremation. Absolutely.
And what happens after the cremation?
So interesting. And yes, absolutely. We'll talk about it.
Hi, I'm Richard Redmick, and I don't have a specific question, but I'm enthused about the idea of a community that actually deals with the issue.
Oh, boy, me too.
Because I've been in a situation where it's not dealt with and it lands in your lap.
Well, the thing about death, right, is that it's going to happen whether or not people decide to talk about it.
Right.
And if there's a community that will talk about it and think it through, you can really be there both for your own families and yourself and for each other in a much healthier way. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, thank you.
Your name, and then we have
Rick Schulman, right? I do have one question that may have come up before. I am interested in the question of cremation.
That did come up. Yeah. Maybe we'll start there and then talk about Shiva. Yeah.
Okay.
I can pass.
I have a question. Great. I have a question about are Jews, more Jews doing green burial, and how is that working?
We can.
You didn't
talk.
Tell us who you were.
Yeah. I'm Rabbi.
Hi. Who you are, and if you have a question.
Sure. Thank you. So instead of being, or I was going to start with, like, you know, when someone is dying, what do you do? And walk there. Instead of being organized, why don't I not? and just respond to questions to start. And then if there's more time after we go into talking about those things, then I'll get organized. So let me start before cremation a bit. In many ways, and I think this is true in the world, of all the life cycle events that the Jewish community deals with, I think we deal with death and dying the best. We seem to get it. So many years ago, when we started the group, the Chevra Kedisha I was telling you about, the group that prepares bodies for burial in the traditional Jewish manner, when we sat down to talk about how to go about doing that, we started to ask each other, okay, look, we're not halachic. We don't obey Jewish law strictly. We're Reconstructionists. So what we do is understand the Jewish law and the way that it works, but we like to look at the values that underlie the law and make our decisions about what we do and how we do it based on those values. So we started exploring what were the Jewish the values that seemed most prominent in Jewish tradition around care of the dead body. And we decided essentially there were three. The first was honoring the dead. That there's a verse in Talmud that says that, and apparently this was true in those days, that you don't treat a pitcher that once held fine wine in a gruff or irreverent manner. You take care of it. You treat it decently. Why? It's only an empty pitcher. And the why was because it once held fine wine. And you honor that pitcher, you treat that pitcher decently because it once held fine wine. So, you know, why do we care about care of the body? We care about care of the body because it once held, you know, fine wine, right? Like that it really makes a difference. So honoring the dead and honoring the body is the first of the three values. Whatever we do with a dead body, as Jews, we should be able to say, we are doing this because we are honoring this body. We are treating it well. Second, a lot of the American funeral industry is designed to let people deny that a death has actually occurred. Yeah. Right? Like, you put somebody, embalm them so that they look full and lovely. You put makeup on them. You have their hair done, and they wear the gown they wore to their son's wedding. Right? So they look stunning. I know, they look... whatever. They look however. But what they don't look like is like any dead body I've ever seen. And I've been doing this ritual of preparing bodies for burial since around 1990. And I've seen a lot of dead bodies, and they look fine, but they look dead. And the point That's the point, right? That the second value in how Jewish tradition handles death is about not denying death. That whatever decision we would make as a group for how to prepare the body would be because we wanted to accept the fact that death actually happened. So when someone calls us on the phone and says, but will you dress my mother in the gown she wore to my son's bar mitzvah, we say, we're not sure you should have tahara, this ritual, because maybe that's the right thing for your mother, but that's not the right thing for us to do. Perhaps that should happen because, you know, that's what you want to have happen. People should do whatever they want to do around death. But that's not what our group decided to do. We do things that we try, and it's a very hard thing to do in many interesting ways. But we try not to deny death because that feels like one of the three main underlying rituals and values. The third is that there is equality in death. That while we are alive, there is no equality. That people who have money have fancy everything and people who don't. And people who have a lot of friends have a lot of friends and people who don't. We do the same ritual in the same way, no matter who the person is. They wear the same set of shrouds. They are buried in a plain pine box. And do people often choose a box that's not a plain pine box for their casket? Yep. And they can certainly do that. And our group will still do the ritual for them. They can choose whatever kind of casket they want. But you don't need it in Jewish tradition. In fact, you don't even need any box. Mm-hmm. Like the green cemeteries that Rabbi Nathan was talking about, you're buried without a casket mm-hmm. at all. And there's no reason why that can't happen. But the important piece, it feels to us that if somebody says, we want something really fancy and special, will you do that? No, we don't do things that are really fancy and special. We do the same ritual for everybody, dressed in the same way, exactly. If you want to pay extra and get something fancy, great, but not us. That doesn't happen. So those are the three values. So that means to me that if you want to make a decision about what should happen to your body after you die, and you want to think like a Reconstructionist Jew while you're doing it, you ask yourself those three questions. How can my body be treated with respect, with honor? How can I not try to do something that everybody else can't possibly do that's like, you know, whatever off the charts that's going to be basically equal? And how can I do something that's not going to let people look at me and deny that I died? Are there a range of different possible answers to that question? There are a range of different possible answers. Jewishly, traditionally, what happens is that somebody dies. The Chevra Kedisha, in English that means sacred community. So the sacred community is called. They come out to, usually in the United States, come to a funeral home because everything is centered around a funeral home, do the ritual, and it's a three-part, it's not just a ritual, it's washing the body, it's pouring water, which is the ritual, and a kind of purification ritual, and then dressing the body in white linen shrouds and placing the body in a casket. The body is then there until the funeral, which is usually the next day. After the funeral, the body is lowered into the earth. There is earth placed on it, and there can be a little earth. Sometimes people just choose to shovel a tiny little bit of earth on the casket. Sometimes people choose to cover the entire casket. Sometimes people choose to fill in the entire grave so that the earth goes to the very top. And that's what happens to the body according to traditional Judaism. So now you get to the year 2019, and we can be realistic. Because there are many people who are Jewish and who are really clearly, firmly Jewish, for whom that ritual is not exactly right. Because they don't feel as if that honors their body in a way that they want it honored. Or they don't feel as if that is the best way for their family not to deny that they're dead, or whatever their rationale is. There are people who choose to do things differently. The biggest way that people are choosing to do things is by cremation. And there are many Jews today who are choosing cremation. And according to the funeral director with whom we work the most, it's going up and up, that there are more and more Jews who are choosing cremation. And people have a range of reasons about why they choose cremation. A lot of times people will say they're choosing cremation because it's environmentally more sound. That was the second half of my sentence. You got it. But in fact, the amount of energy that it takes to burn the entire body is, as you can imagine, quite a bit. And it's very unlikely that you're actually helping the environment by doing that. Second, because there's not a lot of room left for burying bodies. It's true, at some point we will run out of room for burying bodies, but what they did in the medieval cemetery in Prague is start to layer bodies. It's so that if you've ever been to Prague, it's an amazing cemetery where the bodies are on top of each other and you can see the way they were buried. And it's quite something. It doesn't take up much space at all, and there are bodies buried in the earth. But the third reason that people sometimes choose cremation, and this is actually real, is that it costs less. Mm. And in fact, it does. Because for cremation, you don't need a casket. You don't need to buy the plot of land, which is expensive. You don't need a marker, which is expensive. And it can cost quite a bit more. So people will choose cremation. There are lots of reasons that are given about why Jews traditionally don't do cremation. So do you know any? What is it you've heard?
The Holocaust.
The Holocaust is really an interesting one, and that's the first one that always comes up. And there are many people who say because of the Holocaust and because people were forced to have their bodies burned, that we're not going to do that now. And there are Holocaust survivors who agree with that completely and say, how could you do that? There are also, believe it or not, Holocaust survivors who say, I want to be cremated because it was good enough for my family and good enough for my friends and good enough for my community, and I want that too. Yeah.
I think culturally, I mean, I'm from California, where a good portion of just everybody, they're cremated. So both my parents, who were both immigrants, are cremated. All their friends, who were all German Jews, who immigrated,
were cremated.
Yeah. And I think, because you're from California. Mm-hmm. I mean, I bet you know folks who are cremated in California because it's so overwhelmingly the norm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never saw a funeral procession until I came to Pennsylvania.
Wow.
And this is my fourth state.
Wow.
And so I never knew what it was. I never knew the traffic rules around one.
Dangerous.
Until I came here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never.
So how does it feel to the rest of you? Like, before we get to how does it feel, why else do you think Jewish tradition names that it's not, that it doesn't support cremation? And, yeah.
Is it ashes? Came from dust, and so we should return to dust.
It's the dust to dust. It's the going naturally into the earth, that we came naturally, we should go naturally, and that's how ashes to ashes is interpreted. Although, you could do other interpretations, but that clearly, it's that dust to dust. Yeah.
Resurrection.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So there's this great tradition. I love traditions that I don't actually believe in, but that are fascinating, right? So there's this great tradition that when the Mashiach comes, when the Messiah comes, that all of us are going to roll our way to the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. at which point we're all going to rise up and be resurrected. If we are cremated, how can we be resurrected? Because our bodies won't be intact any longer.
We need all our parts.
We need all our parts, which is why, traditionally, Jewishly, all our parts are buried, right? No matter when you die, if previously you had an amputation, your amputated limb would be buried, and then the rest of your body is buried when you die. Because they all have to be there. All your parts have to be there. And it's why the Chevra Kedisha, it's why our group is very, very careful about blood. Because all of the blood, anything that's a part of the body has to be buried. So if somebody, we did a Tahara, I'm sorry, I'm like sometimes a little graphic because, you know, bodies are graphic. We did a Tahara a few weeks ago. We did this ritual a few weeks ago for somebody who must have died. We don't know, but we think must have died in emergency surgery. Because the way that the sewing was done is the way we see it done often if there's either it's done on a dead body or it's done with no assumption that someone is going to live. It's not tight. You know, when you get stitches, they're tight and they're perfect, and these were not. Therefore, we had to be very careful about blood, and we couldn't do the full water pouring because this person would have bled all over. And if the person did, how would we catch the blood? And how would we bury the blood with the person? And if we couldn't bury the blood with the person, when they're resurrected and the Messiah comes, who, you know, it wouldn't, like, who knows? But that's how that custom wound up appearing, and it's a really strong custom. Hi, welcome.
Hi, sorry.
Oh, it's fine. I'm glad you're here. Talking about dead bodies. I know. You are talking about something rational. I'm talking about when the Messiah comes and we all roll to the Mount of Olives. You know, it's not rational. It's not as if, I certainly don't believe that we're rolling to any mountain at any point and that we need our bodies intact. On the other hand, when we do our Tahara, we are very careful about blood. So it almost doesn't matter the source. It matters that we are honoring the person who died in a way that is traditionally Jewish. Yeah. Hi, welcome. Do you want to just tell us your name? Tell me your names, other people?
You know most of them.
She doesn't. But I don't know you.
Okay, Robert Coleman.
Hi, Robert.
I'm Bobby Coleman.
Hi, Bobby. You have very similar names. Thank you.
that also is why when there's been an attack, that there are people who go collect the tissue.
In Israel, when there have been bombings, the Chevra Kedisha groups will go and try to gather any body remnant that they possibly can to make sure they are buried. Both for honoring the person who died, even if you can only honor, you know, a bit of the body, and also, you know, in the future there should be something there so that they too can be resurrected in the time of the Mashiach.
I'm a little longer on the subject of missing parts. That does get into the organ donation.
Yeah, I'm going to hold organ donation and finish cremation, and then
Rich had a question.
Yeah,
that was my question.
Okay, so hold that. Just ask that question in a little bit. So people will say we can't be cremated because of all of these reasons, and yet there are many Jews who now say cremation feels like the best way to honor my body, and it feels really important to me, and I want to do it. And when our group, when our Chevra Kedisha formed, we sat down and we said, will we do the body preparation for a person who later will be cremated? Is that something that feels okay to us? And we decided that we would do it because there are people for whom that feels like the most honoring thing that they could do. And The other value that feels incredibly important to me around death, it's not so much a Jewish value around death in particular, but it is certainly for me and for the group with which I work, is the value of having no judgment around death. Mm. That, you know, if somebody chooses to do something according to Jewish ritual because they find that the most honoring and the most significant, they should do it. And if somebody doesn't, they should not. Like we've told people that we won't do. I've told people when people are calling to ask if they can have a tahara, if they can have the body preparation, I'll sometimes talk to them and ask, you know, why they want it, whatever. And when they say, well, actually, we'd sort of like it, but we think that our grandmother who died really wanted to be buried in her gown and really wanted to be made up and really, but we think maybe this is the right thing to do. I think it's the wrong thing to do, because I think that to honor this person, which feels like the most important of any of these values, you do what they really wanted around death. That all says to me that you make a really clear decision around what you want around your body when you die. And you make sure that everybody close to you knows and is clear about what they should do. So if you have not written an advance directive, which is like the statement where you get to say, I'll tell a lot of things about your death, when you want to be resuscitated or not, and how you want your body treated and what you want to happen after you die, you should do it. Even if you plan on living till 120, which we all do, you should still do it and make sure that people know where it is. Because if you say, I have it in my will, I will tell you that if your will is read a week after you die, it's not going to help. And that is very often what happens, that people read a will later. You know, whenever the lawyer gets it and it happens and whatever, and by then you're buried or not, or cremated or not. Like it's, but it should happen. And we do more and more, preparing a body, pouring the water, dressing it in shrouds, and then know that it's going to be taken to be cremated. You know, like the Jewish community is always interesting, if nothing else. We are always interesting. Yeah.
Speaking as a survivor, as a sense, you know, we have a family plot. We have most of the family buried there. When my sister died, her children had her cremated, and they took her ashes and they went down to the seashore because that's what she loved.
Yeah.
And
they scattered them.
So the tradition that we have as a survivor of going to visit the graves before the high holidays, I assume that's tradition and not law.
It's not law, it's tradition. But it's a nice tradition. Yeah.
It's a nice tradition. I miss her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So I'll tell you what people... Yeah, yes, and what people sometimes do, you can put up a gravestone. Or a marker, even if there's not a body there. Yeah, yeah. People do, you ask what people do with the ashes, and the answer is so many things, right? Like sometimes people bury them, we'll buy a plot, and we'll bury them in a cemetery. And we'll do a burial ceremony the same way that it's done with a body, except it's done with the what they call cremains, right? It's done with the cremains. Sometimes people will scatter them someplace. It's not exactly legal, but people do it all the time. And it seems to be just fine. I did a funeral for somebody who, after she died, had her ashes put in lockets, like 10 or 11 lockets, because she was a person who had many nieces, and she wanted her nieces to each have, you know, a little bit of her to remember her, and they do. You can do almost anything with ashes, and there's no reason why not.
The Beth Israel, I believe the cemetery where we have plots for Beth Israel has a location for cremains.
What cemetery?
Haryuda.
Oh, it might.
Yeah.
It that's an old cemetery, Haryuda.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
A new so, thing that they have.
Yeah, good. All of the Jewish cemeteries in the Philadelphia area, except the Orthodox cemetery, there is an Orthodox cemetery. All of the others now allow ashes. And they also, the other thing that they all allow that they never always used to is interfaith couples to be buried there. You can be buried in all Jewish cemeteries except the Orthodox if you're not Jewish. Yeah, and you want to.
And when we get to the conversation about Evergreen, I know that the Evergreen Cemetery in New Jersey has a place to bury cremains as well as bodies.
Mm-hmm. And there, yeah. So can I can we talk about green burial for a minute, and then we'll move on to other things. So there are cemeteries in the area that have green burial. The one that I tend to go to the most is West Laurel Hill, which is not out near here, but it's kind of Bala Cynwyd area. It's
like, they're green.
Well, excuse me?
Are they green? Or
they have a green area.
Oh.
The old cemetery is not. It's an old, largely Christian, but not entirely cemetery. There's a large Jewish area now. It took a long time to build the Jewish area because the Orthodox Jews and the Reformed Jews on the main line in Philly were arguing about whether to allow people who weren't Jewish to be buried there. And the Orthodox Jews said, but if someone not Jewish is buried there, I can't be buried there. And the Reform movement all said, but half of our members are not Jewish. And we can't be buried there if you don't allow non-Jews. So there are two Jewish sections. It's the desert island with the synagogue
it's the same exact.
There's an Orthodox section and there's a section for other Jews where the one doesn't allow interfaith, the other does. But they will allow cremains at West Laurel Hill, and they have an area for ashes, and they have an area that's green. Mm-hmm. And there are a few cemeteries in the area that now have green.
My sister's in Steelmantown in New Jersey.
In New Jersey.
It's just a shroud. And just right. It's so right there in the earth, there's no lining.
No lining, and no individual, at least at West Laurel Hill, there are no individual markers. There is, which is kind of interesting, there's a kind of a wall that is low, but just like marks where the green area starts. And on it are like tiny little metal plaques with the names and dates of people who have died who are buried in the green area, so that that you can't tell individually where someone is, but you have the name there, so you can be buried in a shroud. You can also, there's a new thing that people call a mushroom suit.
Yes.
You read about the mushroom?
I heard about it on NPR. Yes.
Yeah, everybody heard about it on NPR, right? It's a very cool thing. It's a, I mean, if you get it, this stuff gets me excited.
Grows mushrooms.
Exactly. Like, you're buried, and what you wear is they're seeds that are connected, and you're buried, and what grows out of them is mushrooms, so that you're growing mushrooms. You're actually growing living things from the outfit you're wearing, and you decompose very quickly, which feels as if, in Jewish tradition, it's in some ways ideal, because if you want to go back into the earth as quickly as you can, if you wear the mushroom suit, you go back really quickly.
So. I've also seen a pod structure where you're buried, and there's a tree.
Yeah.
There's wicker baskets also that you can do a green
one. Yep.
And at Steelmantown, they do have separate places where you're buried.
For each person.
And and what was really lovely is that they have a pile of rocks, and you can choose your own rock and have someone engrave on it. And so,
oh, nice.
And so all the heads, they're not these uniform headstones. They're just these really...
Well, that sounds beautiful.
Lovely rocks. Yeah,
that sounds quite beautiful.
It's in the Pine Barrens, all the way to the beach.
So you have a lot of choice. really, for when you die. And if you're in this area and you know someone who says, I want to be cremated, if the idea of tahara, of the Jewish burial practice of honoring the body, is appealing to them and to you, you can do both. You can have it both ways. There's something about being able to honor a body that is very powerful. And I sometimes talk about it as the most spiritually moving thing that I do. And the truth is, it's also the most mundane because, you know, we're talking for a few minutes and I'm already talking about gathering blood and how stitches are done because it's very just physical and you're dealing with a body. And there's something also very powerful about being there that people sometimes think of it as soul escort, which is really, I think, quite lovely. So then, moving back.
Stay with the body until the funeral?
So we as a group don't do that. We decided that we were afraid that we wouldn't be able to do it because it means not only staying with the body from the tahara to the burial, which is usually from the night before till the next morning, but from death until the funeral. You want a shomer. You want someone to be there to guard the body. And that tradition probably comes out of a tradition of making sure that mice and rats don't hurt the body, actually. It was probably a lot of the traditions that we have that feel the most beautiful and the most spiritual or the most, like, for absolute, physical reasons. That was probably why, but it wound up being an opportunity. Traditionally, people read psalms while they sit with the dead body from death until the funeral. I know many people who decide what they want read after they die. It doesn't have to be psalms that people are sitting there reading. You know, it can be any texts that have real meaning for you. If you love poetry, if you have a particular book that's something that's a favorite, if like something that feels right for you. And again, that needs to be in your advance directive so that people know to do it. Otherwise, it won't help that you have this great idea. But so we don't choose to do it because we thought we couldn't do it. But we have, many of us have done what's called a shmira, like being a shomer or a shomera, being a guard of the body, have volunteered to do it when communities do. So that's something, I don't know if Beth Israel ever does, but that's something you can organize as a community. If somebody in the community dies or a relative dies and it has meaning for people to have somebody being there from the death till the funeral, you can organize that and have people go in groups, usually pairs, and often stay for 2-hour stretches. And the hardest, obviously, are, 2 to 4 a.m., 4 to 6 a.m. I mean, the middle of the night, it's hard to get people, but not impossible. Not impossible. People will step up and really do it. Yeah.
Do you want to go back to organ donation?
Yeah, I want to go back to organ donation. So I don't know. I'll tell you what I don't know, and then I'll tell you what I do know. What I don't know is exactly where Jewish law is right now on organ donation because it keeps moving. So I have slightly old information about Jewish law, but what I know is, as a Reconstructionist, how I deal with it. So you could have an Orthodox rabbi come in and do that for you, or someone who really knows more of the details, because I don't. In general, the guideline for Jewish law around organ donation has been and still is that it is considered acceptable to donate an organ if it saves a life, right? Because pikuach nefesh, saving a life, is essential always. And that's the bottom line. So the bottom line for the way that Jewish law is built around organ donation is around whether or not it will save a life. The reason that the details that I don't know is because it changes so quickly how to understand what saving a life is. Like many years ago, the Orthodox mostly interpreted that as it had to be very narrowly understood. Like you had to give your heart because it was saving the life of another person who needed a heart, and without that heart would die, and with your heart would live. And it had to be one on one. That would be it. So if I wanted to do a skin donation because there were people whose skin was severely disfigured because of fire, they would say, well, does it save their life? And it may not save their life, but it may save the quality of their life. But that, in 20 years ago, most Orthodox rabbis would have said, no, that's not okay. It's really very narrowly about saving a life. And then some rabbis started saying, well, how do you understand life? Like, let's understand life a little more broadly. And there are Orthodox rabbis who say that it's about quality of life. So what the first thing that got accepted is the donation of corneas. Because being blind, if one didn't have to be blind, could possibly lead to the end of your life, or certainly severely damage the quality of your life.
You couldn't study Torah,
and that's life, right? You got it. It just made such a difference that for most Orthodox rabbis, that was considered okay. But still not all, because back to the entire body needing to be buried whole. Like, this stops the entire body from being buried whole. And that is huge for people who genuinely believe that that person will not be able to be resurrected in the time of the Mashiach. If someone really believes that, then how can they do it? It's when someone is severely anti-abortion, anti-choice, because they say it's murder. If you really see it as murder, how can you murder somebody? Like, I get that. Like, how can you murder somebody? So it feels like the same kind of argument to me, and there's really no way to argue that. For a Reconstructionist, in general, the way that it's looked at is, if you can really make a difference in the life of other people, then that organ should be donated. And most Reconstructionists I know will donate organs. The question comes in with larger donations. The question often comes in with, can I donate my entire body to science? And then there are arguments, there are arguments of both sides. There are those who say that now, really medical students and others who are studying don't need so many bodies. And we've done this in a way that we don't need to do now, that we can, with computers, have people learn with many, many fewer bodies so that we don't need so many donations. So do we need whole bodies donated to science? It's a real question. And there are those who say, yeah, if someone is studying to be a doctor, they still need it, even if there are alternative means to get them there. But that you can argue about whether or not, even as a Reconstructionist, like saying, okay, if what we want to argue is how do you best honor this body, for me, I would say, honor my body by donating as much as you can possibly donate if it will make a difference in the future. Which means for me, if I die of some weird disease and that it can make a difference studying that, please take my organs, take whatever. I would love to make a difference in the life of somebody. There are other perfectly good Reconstructionists who would say, well, let's think about that. I think maybe the best way to honor my body would be to just honor my body and to treat it with respect and to treat it gently. And I will do as much as I can possibly do now while I'm alive. But once I die, I would like my body to just go into the earth, or I would like my body to just be cremated, or I would like something else to happen with my body. Yeah.
Okay, so traditionally, we bury someone within 24 to 48 hours.
As fast as we can.
But when you have this intervention of organ donation going on,
Does it sometimes take a little longer? So organ donation tends to not take longer because organs need to be donated as quickly as is humanly possible, right? Ideally, right after death, like the minute someone dies. What?
Somebody has
to know.
Somebody has to know to call. Write it on your advance directive. Tell everybody who's close to you that that's what you want. And it may happen and it may not. That depends. You know, but yeah, to try to do it as quickly as is humanly possible, so that doesn't wind up taking longer. Some things do wind up taking longer. Autopsy can delay a burial. And the question around autopsy is a very similar question, where if that autopsy can really save someone's life by studying that disease, should one do the autopsy? As a reconstructionist, that's up to you to decide if that's the best way to honor the body. Overwhelmingly, the Orthodox, unless there is really somebody dying of that disease and you know that you're going to make a difference really clearly, they tend to side on the against doing it. But
I just wanted to answer Lois a little bit, which is gift of life, which is the organ donation folks.
Yeah.
They're absolutely on their toes and prepared to be very responsive, and they're not actually vultures. I don't want to make a joke about
great
it. They're
people.
Great. They're terrific
they're great people,
but they do hang out and are available, and so.
And if you care about the organ donation, it's worth signing up.
My driver's license says it.
License says it. That's a good step.
So they're prepared to be responsive to the various hospitals and are aware when there's an imminent passing. Obviously, if there's been a tragic immediate death, it's less easy for them to be responsive. But they can be there. I've seen that.
And you let people know. Which means, having your death rituals done the way that you would like them done is really primarily about letting other people know how you want them done. And if you have children who will otherwise be responsible for figuring it out and making the decisions, it is an extreme act of kindness to have things pre-planned and to do as much pre-planning as one possibly can.
Just one note, when you said autopsy, if you want it or family want it, it's often not your choice.
That is correct.
That the medical establishment just takes it over and...
They decide, unless you say on religious grounds you don't want it done. They're usually pretty good.
Sometimes it is absolutely not your choice.
Great, love to hear that. There's a story behind that, I would think. Yeah, it shouldn't be, because but what's really interesting, the Hasidic, local Hasidic communities don't trust the medical establishment at all, because they're afraid that that's going to happen and someone's going to do something that will violate Jewish law. They will steal bodies from hospitals. They will whisk them away. They will absolutely, and it's for that. It's to say, we don't want you doing this. We don't trust you. And obviously, according to your implied story, they shouldn't.
But if the courts are going to get involved, or if there's anything of that nature, if there's a hint that anything might happen even before you have said anything, the court examiner will get involved. So there are two different people who will do an autopsy. Just to say that before you even become conscious of what's happening, and
it's happening.
Said a word, a court examiner
is there and ready and acting.
Yes.
In particular, in cases where there is suspected suicide or murder, but not always. Yeah, or something else. Okay, so. We're at 8:22. So where should we go? Shiva was the first question. So let me hand out, I'm not going to read these in particular, but I don't know if they're enough. I hope so. If not, I would ask you to share, or if you're here with somebody with whom you share a home, if you would share a reading, that would be very nice to take home. So let's talk about Shiva. I also have a few things to give out about cremation that you can take home, both an Orthodox view and a Reform view about cremation. So Shiva. Shiva's really interesting, right? So the word Shiva means seven. And it means seven because in Jewish tradition, Shiva is observed for 7 days. So what that means is that after the funeral, families go back either to, and that, this book, I see you looking at it, this book came from what I think is a really great read. It's called Saying Kaddish, How to Comfort the Dying, Bury the Dead, and Mourn as a Jew by Anita Diamond. And she's a really good writer, and she's written a book about just about every life cycle possible. And this is really good and really clear, and you'll see if you like the chapter on Shiva, you'll love the rest of the book about that, because it's actually very, it's really well written and really, really clear. And in addition, I don't know if Richard ever described this to you, but if you're interested in life cycle from a Reconstructionist approach, all of life cycle, this was edited by David Teutsch and is called a Guide to Jewish Practice. Volume 3 is on life cycle, and this is sold through the Reconstructionist movement, so you can get it through the Reconstructionist
practice. Rabbi Hertz, he wrote the chapter on.
He wrote the chapter in here.
We're just confused about some handouts. Some of us have some.
Oh, did I give out the
dying? Then there's something called the first year, and then there's something called Shiva the 7 days.
Who's care of the dying?
I think Shiva the 7 days is what you were.
This Shiva the 7 days is what I was thinking. But if you have the others, you can take them too.
I have the others. I'm not sure everybody else has the others.
Yeah, that's the smile.
I have care of the dying.
Oh, good. That's good. Except they're not dead yet. In that, I'm sorry. I dropped my papers when I was out in the okay. parking lot, and then picked them up, and they didn't wind up in the same pile. So I'm sorry about that. Try to have a Shiva or share a Shiva with someone next to you. So Shiva is 7 days, and the thing about Shiva is that the way that it's traditionally understood is that it's divided into two parts. That the first 3 days are considered the most intense, that where people are mourning the most deeply and are most deeply into their grief. And the second 4 days are this is all theoretical, right? Like, this is not like, you may have totally different experiences, but theoretically, the next 4 days, people are still deeply in mourning for the entire week and are not ready to leave their home and are not ready to do anything except be at home. But it's slightly lighter than the first 3 days. You're starting to accept the fact that the person died, perhaps. It's like more things are going on with you. So the customs of Shiva, so you know the customs of traditional Shiva, if that's so, just call them out, say them.
And the mourners sit on a hard bench.
You sit on a bench, often lower, often harder, because mourning hurts, and so does that.
And you're not supposed, and the mourners are, people entering a mourner's house aren't really just supposed to go up to the mourners and see if they want to be spoken to. If not, they're supposed to leave them alone.
Just sit. So that is what a traditional Shiva looks like. What a traditional Shiva looks like, bless you, is that you're in mourning. You come home. There are customs, like that mirrors in a house are often covered. Again, it's not, they don't have to be. If they're not, they're not. But if they can be, I think it's a great custom, because what it does is take away the need to look at yourself and focus on yourself. Because the truth is that when you're in mourning, you don't look great. You know, and that's not where you're supposed to be, what you're supposed to be worried about. You're not worried about how you look. You're just being, and being in grief and being in mourning. So you just come home and you sit. And the first thing that happens is that that people give you what's called the meal of consolation. It's the first meal that you eat when you arrive back at the house of mourning. That's what would happen traditionally. And then you would sit there, and if you need anything, you ask people, and they give you whatever it is you need to eat or to drink or whatever. And people come in and sit. And the only thing that they say is usually when they leave. And if unless you want to talk to them, you as mourner are welcome to. And mourners are, right, parents, children, siblings, partners. And if you are one of those, you take your shoes off. And people either wear socks or barefoot, and because leather shoes, outdoor shoes, are considered symbols of the outdoors, of working, of being outside, and you don't do that. People who shave don't shave. There's just a sitting. You just sit on these low benches, and people bring you food, come in to see you, and they sit down on a regular chair, and they sit down quietly, and they're there. And when they leave, they say the words, "Hamakom yinachem etchem betoch sha'ar avelei Tzion v'Yerushalayim." May the may you be comforted. May the Holy One comfort you along with all of those in Zion and Jerusalem who mourn. And if people don't know those words, they can just say, "May you be comforted," and then they leave. And that's what a traditional Shiva is. And that happens for 7 days. So the first day is the day of the funeral. So it's not really 7 days, right? Because the first day is the day of the funeral, and it ends at when it gets dark. It ends at sunset. And then the second day starts, and that ends at sunset, and the third day and the fourth day, up through the sixth day. And the seventh day, in the morning, you get up and walk, sit a little bit, and then get up and walk around the block, which is the way Shiva is ended. The only other thing that traditionally happens during Shiva is services. And there is an evening service. It can be an afternoon and evening in the most traditional homes, and there can be a morning service. And that way, your entire community, if you are in a community that comes to a minyan in the morning and in the afternoon and in the evening, two or three times a day, if the afternoon and evening are joined, you have an entire group of people coming in and seeing you. And Shiva lasts all day and all evening from, you know, the time you wake up till the time that you're tired and you go to bed. And otherwise, it just lasts. And during the day, if other people are working, whoever can come, comes. And whoever is able to be present is present. And if people are not, they're not. But they come and go, and they do that sitting and that quiet. So now it's 2019, and now it's our lives and our world.
Kids are in California.
Right.
Okay.
But on Shabbat, though, in those civilizations.
I'm sorry. The other reason that it's not fully 7 days is that from Friday, when Shabbat starts, through Saturday night at Havdalah, when Shabbat ends, there is no Shiva. And you go to shul. So you see the community because you go to services. And, of course, your entire community is there at services. So you're going to see them. Now we get 2019. So, can anyone describe a Shiva house and what it's like for you?
It's like a freaking park.
Well, hold on a minute. You want to describe it in more detail? There's a microphone coming.
I just want to know where that community is, where your entire community is.
I have not been to that shul yet. It's like
my mother-in-law died in 2014, and we would not. She was aged and infirm. Her friends were also not able to come. We would not have been able to even sit one day of Shiva without this Beth Israel community. But for me, who was not a traditional mourner, being the daughter-in-law, it was a party all 3 days. People came in, and we had to provide the food for people, and we got desserts, and that was great. But people would come at night. We would have services at night. But we had to provide the food. It was really a burden.
It's really interesting how that has shifted. Because that shifted, that's one shift that has happened a lot in our world, where my assumption, and I have a community that gets the tradition. I teach in a rabbinical school. They're supposed to get this. And they do get it. And when my parents died, we called a deli and got bagels and lox and all of this stuff and lots of cakes because that was the assumption. And the assumption in my family, it would never have occurred to them that I wouldn't provide the food. And that is not what the traditional Shiva is about. But it is what we do. And I knew really clearly that, first of all, it would not have been okay for me to have people come into my house and for us not to have enough to eat. Like, that would be mortifying. And if this is supposed to be comforting the mourner, I would not have felt comfortable. I would have felt completely uncomfortable. So, in order to shift it from that, that takes a lot of re-education on the part of whole communities to get people to learn to bring food to a Shiva house. That's thing one. Thing two is the difference between walking in and sitting down in quiet and waiting until the people who are mourning want to talk. Right? That does not happen in our Shiva houses. It just doesn't. And if I walked into a Shiva home and didn't say anything to the mourners, they would think I was rude. They wouldn't understand what I was doing at all. They would think it was totally bizarre. So when everybody in the community walks in and starts talking to the mourners or to whoever else is there, because that's just what you do, you wind up with a feeling of kind of party. And it's really interesting to try to structure a Shiva in a way that still makes people all feel comfortable, because I'm not interested in making people feel uncomfortable. I'm not going to, you know, have them put signs up that say, be silent when you walk in, because everyone would be uncomfortable and think it was really bizarre. But how to shift the feeling from party to house of mourning? You know, that's really the question. Whether or not we are obeying the exact customs, but getting ideas of how to do that. Yeah.
I think the Shiva I had for my husband was probably the only Shiva I've been to that was an AM Shiva. It was at 7:45 in the morning.
Yeah, yeah, nice.
And people came before they went to work.
It's great.
It's the end of the week. It's my kids were 7 and 10. Towards the end of the week, the girls were then going to school.
Yeah.
And, you know, people didn't bring that much food. Except, I mean, people, I didn't cook for a month, so the community was cooks for a month.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember one person bought Cheerios because I'd forgotten to feed my eldest. and that was sort of like the best thing that somebody could have ever bought. It was an AM Shiva. It did not have the feeling of a party.
Nice. That's great. The morning doesn't. It feels really different in the morning.
People came in, and the Shiva started, and it was very much, we're going to do the Shiva, and then people left. But there was very little lingering and the feeling of, you know, give me a pastry. It was very much that this is here for a purpose.
Nice. That's great. That's really great. Yeah, I mean, I found that with my family as well. I found it as if people were there, but much, and we did both. We did a morning and an evening, and it was a very different feel, the morning from the evening. Like, the morning, people were there for the service, and then to just be with me for a while, and those who could stay stayed. And I loved sitting Shiva during the day. I loved it, and I know most people don't do it now, and it was lovely because I was just there. And if I wanted to relax and read a book, I could. And then when people came, it would be one or two people who came so that I could have real conversations with people who were there. And it was surprisingly beautiful to have that happen. And that's it. The morning is really a different thing.
The morning is very different.
I think it is. I think it's where to go. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think you touched on this, but I became aware as a grown-up, I guess, that what we have as a Shiva minion is detached in a lot of ways from what I understand some of this purpose to be, which is for people who daven every day, for them to not have to leave the house mm-hmm. to daven.
It's a piece of it,
the
yeah.
minion yeah, yeah. comes to them.
Yeah, yeah.
And here we are in a community of people who don't daven every day.
Mm-hmm.
Don't daven every week. But who, you know, who don't daven every day. And
yeah.
so there's a detachment of, well, why are we gathering? What are we doing here? And yes, of course, it's comfort and meaning, but I think that that also colors the environment of the gathering. It changes the meaning of the gathering because it's like, oh, right, we have to shut up now because we're going to
have the service,
this
right.
service, as opposed to that we're here so that you can pray.
So let me respond to that, because I've seen people do a range of different things in response to exactly that. So first of all, in general, and I assume you do in your community, before Kaddish or at some point during the service, stop and talk about the person who died and remember the person who died. So more and more what I experience is that that's really the highlight of that. That's really the meaning behind it. And the service, for people for whom a service is meaningful, that's lovely. But the real meaning is in remembering the person who died. So I've done several shivas where people say, well, I'd really like people to get together and do something where we just, in a sort of organized way, talk about the person who died so that we can do it as a family and as a community, and so that my community can know when to come and learn about, you know, my parent whom they've never met, or whoever it is who died whom they've never met. And we've done evenings where there isn't a service, where people will sing a nigun or a song or something, or read a poem, or have a moment of quiet and gather and talk. And for some people, that's better.
Mm-hmm.
That's better because it doesn't feel as if, oh, I don't know the prayers. Oh, I'm going to feel awkward. Oh, that's not going to feel okay. Let me do that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that when we like doing services for a family for whom like a minion is not something that they ever do or has meaning for them, sometimes they have a memory of some of the prayers, like the Shema will sometimes be there for people who don't do a lot of praying now but who in their life have learned something, or there are a couple. So we'll do a very limited. We'll do the Shema and some quiet and then talk about the person who died and then Kaddish. Because a lot of people want Kaddish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Mourner's Kaddish, it's so interesting because Mourner's Kaddish, which as everywhere you read, the first sentence is Mourner's Kaddish, which has nothing to do with death, right? Like, because it has nothing to do with death. But it has everything to do with death in our world, because that's when we all together say it. And even if the words are about the greatness of God and the power of God and the power, the beauty of the name of God and how we amplify the name of God, people who don't believe in God at all still find Mourner's Kaddish an important thing to say, not because the words speak to them, but because the experience of saying Kaddish speaks to them. So often, if you have the opportunity to do something and start it, and then talk about the person who died, and then say Kaddish, that can work for people when a whole service can't. It does work. I mean, and not for everybody. Because for some people, having the service really is what is the most meaningful thing for them to do. So it's about being able to, you know, think about what it has meaning for you and what would be most important to you. Because you can then talk to those people who are leading the Shiva Minyan or the whatever it is, whatever they're going to be doing. And you can have something that resonates for you and for your family. Yeah.
This was going to just reflect at sometimes my experience of a Shiva Minyan is that first that people in the community want to be able to do something,
mm-hmm.
and this gives them a structure to
be there, right?
Plug in and,
yep.
and be there. But it does seem like there's this flurry of some kind of activity, whatever you call it, where like people jump in, descend on the house. Which can be sort of good in a distracting way for a mourner, until then when it's quiet, then they can see.
Yeah, yeah. Which is why I would do something, whether or not the service is the right thing for people. Like, the idea of doing something then is great. Because it does do that. You know, it brings people in. And people who want to do something. I've known people who... I remember sitting Shiva, and I was saying how I loved it during the day, but when there were a couple of people who, when they walked into my house during the day and they were the only ones there, obviously felt a little bit, oh, did I do this right? You know, because they were sort of afraid that, like, oh, is this the right thing? And I said immediately, I'm so thrilled that you're here. Come, you know, let's sit down, let's talk. But it's easier for a community to come at a set time and to know that there's going to be a community there. That being said, there has to be a community there, which is why the other ideal of Shiva is that everybody comes. And you don't have to know the person. You don't have to be friends with the person. You don't have to have ever met the person. If it goes out on the Beth Israel, whatever list you have, then for people to go and to be present, that's what matters. Whether or not you're obeying the exact, you know, the exact rules of how it's done. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So are there other Shiva questions? Or I'm going to go to another piece that's... Okay, so then the final piece I wanted to look at, and I hope I have... It's in here someplace. Hold on. No, come on. What I want is... Actually, some of you kind of have it. Do some of you have the thing about caring for the dying?
Yeah.
Could I have one of them? Great. Why don't you pass some of those around? I don't know how many there are, but you're welcome to one. And what I wanted to do is go back to before death, because we tend to think that... you know, that Catholics have something called confessional and Jews don't do anything when people are dying, when in fact we do. And we have something that is called a vidui. And a vidui is something that you know from Yom Kippur. If you pay attention to the names of different things in the service, the vidui is the list of the confessional at Yom Kippur. You know, when you're, for the sin that I have committed for this or that or the other thing or all that, right, that's a vidui. And there is something that's called a confessional that is said when someone is dying. And it can be said by the person who's dying if they realize that they are, in fact, dying but are still conscious and able to speak, or by somebody for them. If someone is not able to speak or to read, but a family member or rabbi or someone else can do it for them. And you'll get a couple of examples in here. So here is one on the page that in here says, I'm going to read a couple of them out loud. It's on the page that says page 41. I know. It's like, right. Yeah, no, well, I pulled it out of that book, so it's the 41st page of that book. So it says, "My God and God of all who have gone before me, author of life and death, I turn to you in trust. Although I pray for life and health, I know that I am mortal. If this life must soon end, let me die, I pray, at peace. If only my hands were clean and my heart pure. I confess that I committed many wrongs and left so much undone. Yet I know also the good that I did and tried to do. May those acts give meaning to my life and may my errors be forgiven. Protector of the bereaved and the helpless, watch over my loved ones in whose souls my soul is bound. You who are my rock and my redeemer, the source of mercy and truth, into your hands I commend my spirit. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, Adonai is our God. Adonai is one. Adonai is our God. Adonai is our God." So that's one example. What do you think?
beautiful.
It really is.
It's a nice translation.
Yeah. So tell me what appeals to you about it.
It's brevity.
Hey.
No, I'm serious.
Yes, that's right. It says just very succinctly what one might want to say. Yeah. Are there any other particular pieces that jump out at you? Yeah.
The idea that I'll be judged on the good stuff and not on the bad stuff.
Not the bit, right.
That at the end, that will matter.
That you were a blend in life. And that, yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
By all means.
In caring for the gravely ill, when do you wheel this out?
It's a good question. So there is a very strong tradition that one can say the vidui, that like many have said the vidui and not died, and others have said it and have died. And therefore, if it is said and you don't die, you didn't die, no harm. Because it's not saying you're definitely dying now. But if there is a fear that someone is dying, then they want it. Then people often want it said. I would not, as a rabbi, go into a room of someone with whom there was a question around that and say, you know, like, if they didn't know that they were, like, how would you like a vidui now?
I've got a cold.
You know, like, exactly. No.
I broke my leg.
Yeah, no. No, no, no. I want to read, a somewhat different one. I want to read the one on page 44 and see what you think of this. This is by Rabbi Rami Shapiro. I acknowledge before the source of all that life and death are not in my hands. Just as I did not choose to be born, so I do not choose to die. May it come to pass that I may be healed. But if death is my fate, then I accept it with dignity and the loving calm of one who knows the way of all things. May my death be honorable, and may my life be a healing memory for those who know me. May my loved ones think well of me, and may my memory bring them joy. From all those I may have hurt, I ask forgiveness. Upon all who have hurt me, I bestow forgiveness. As a wave returns to the ocean, so I return to the source from which I came. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, hear, O Israel, that which we call God is oneness itself. Blessed is the way of God, the way of life and death, of coming and going, of meeting and loving, now and forever. As I was blessed with the one, so now am I blessed with the other. Shalom, shalom, shalom. Mm. Yeah. It's less brief.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So there is always a tradition that the last words that you say before you die are the Shema. And that's actually one of the reasons we say the Shema at bedtime, because there's a tradition at bed, not because there's a thought that you'll die when you're asleep, although you might, but that sleep is in tradition considered a time when perhaps your soul leaves for a bit and then comes back in the morning. And just in case it forgets to come back in, you know, you will have said the Shema. And it's kind of out of a little bit of that that you say the bedtime Shema.
Which has a liturgy of forgiveness.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Like cleaning the slate.
Of making sure that when you go to sleep, just in case.
I've heard the story that we talk about practicing religion. We practice our religion, and that saying the Shema, being in the habit of saying the Shema, is practicing so that it's on the tip of our tongue when we need it, and that we then that there's this ideal of dying on the word Echad.
Lovely.
Breath.
Lovely. Thank you. That's
and
really
you can't
beautiful.
Do that if you haven't been saying it every day.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's really beautiful. And for me, the Shema, that's what it's about. It's not really about God, except in that if we understand God as what unites us, makes everything one, And that if we are all one and everything is one, and if as you die you are becoming just another part of that oneness, right, that it's we're all in it, living and dead. It's all one. So saying the Shema is acknowledging that. And that feels particularly powerful at the moment of death. So there are different, you'll see these, there are different viduis, there are different final confessionals. They almost all end in Shema. And they almost all end he ends with the word shalom, and shalom means wholeness or fullness in addition to peace, right? So it's that. But it's like ending with oneness and ending with fullness and ending with wholeness. And it can be very powerful. And it can be done. What's also interesting about it is that in the same way that Yom Kippur, the vidui on Yom Kippur, we are told, does not work so effectively unless we have spent time leading up to Yom Kippur doing our work with other people and asking for forgiveness and sorting out what we've done and what we need to be forgiven for. That the same around death, that before death, what this is supposed to be is something that gives us the impetus to work out what we need to work out with our families and friends before we die. That it's not just say the vidui and all's well. It's sort out what you need to sort out. So if there's anything left over, and if you have any anger at anyone, to work that out with them, and if you know that other people have anger at you or you've done something that you wish for forgiveness for, to work that out. And then when you're dying and the vidui is said, there's an incredible amount of power to it. In addition to just the beauty of the reading, and it can be done by entire families. I've done a vidui. You might have too, where entire families are there at the bedside surrounding a person, and each person can have the opportunity to say what they want to say to the person who's dying. So this can be expanded into a much fuller ritual if you're interested in doing it, where you have the opportunity of saying what you want to the person who's dying, and if they are able, they have the opportunity to say what they want to you. And it can all be there. It can all be whole. As a very beautiful ritual, in fact. Or not. There are people I've known who have said, I don't want that. Like, I don't want any final acknowledgement that I'm dying, in which case you shouldn't have it. Like,
I mean, a lot of times the dying person isn't always able to, they can hear, but they can't always speak. So.
Yeah, yeah. Which is another reason why in your advanced directive, if you would like to make sure that you have a vidui before you die, you write it and you tell people that you want that before. You have the whole list of things that you want around your death. And if these are things that are appealing to you and they're things that you want, the more people that have those messages, the more likely it is that they'll happen.
I just want to, again, talk about advanced directives and the favor that you're doing for the people who are near and dear to you. I worked... I think, as you know, I was a hospice chaplain, and in my training and at the hospital, the family angst and anxiety trying to figure out what would mom want. I don't know what mom wants. And then it opened the way for siblings to fight with each other.
Seeing so much fighting.
So much fighting because this is what so and so wants, and then this is what so and so wants, and it's really not about that. Or maybe, I don't know.
Ideally, it's not about that.
I know that I think this group came to this session tonight, so maybe I'm preaching to the choir, but tend to not want to talk about death and prepare for our dying, but it would be a big favor.
It is. I mean, I've seen people fight over every step of the way, right? Especially around, cremation or burial. I've seen two children in a family, adult children in a family, just screaming at each other, and it go back to the very first thing that I said, which is that the main reason that we're doing these rituals is to honor the person who died. it is just not honoring if the children are screaming at each other about what to do around the burial or the treatment of the body.
It's not about the burial. It's about
a million things.
It's about the scissors,
right?
When they were five. And
well, everything. Nothing that adult siblings do is actually about what's currently happening. No. But pretty much. So we're moving towards 9 o'clock, and if there are final anything left over, or because I don't want to start a whole new topic because we have like 3 minutes, that would be.
Is there any quick question that you didn't get answered that you need, or did this really spoke to? I think what we.
Good.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Really, anything. I mean, I like talking about death more than I like talking about most things. So, much to the chagrin of my partner and children. But so, anytime you want to talk about death, I'll start at a different angle and we'll work our way in. So, thank you.
And I did get to hear Rabbi Linda Holtzman talk about this in the Kaddish podcast.
Oh yeah, yeah. If you listen to podcasts, the Kaddish podcast that Ariana Katz did, she asked me to talk about the Chevra Kaddisha, and yeah, and the way we started our group is often a story that winds up being that I wind up telling because it was about AIDS and the AIDS crisis, and the Orthodox Chevra Kaddisha in Philadelphia was not comfortable doing the tahara, doing the body preparation for people with AIDS. And I had a man who was dying, who said to me, "Look, I really want a group that respected me while I'm alive, and to be preparing my body for burial." And when I learned that group's response to doing the ritual around people with HIV/AIDS, I called a group together and said, "Can we start a Chevra Kaddisha of our own?" And we did, and we've been doing this since 1990. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. So yeah.
Thank you
all. A great group. I love Beth Israel. I wish I lived nearer to meet her.
You too.
Thank you.
I just got a